Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com, and this is anti-war news for Tuesday, October 18th, 2022. First story at the top of antiwar.com today. The Senate is looking to give Taiwan $10 billion in military aid. So the Senate's version of the 2023 National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, that is the annual Pentagon spending bill, it will include $10 billion in military aid for Taiwan. This is according to a report from Defense News. The $10 billion would be given to Taiwan over 5 years in the form of foreign military financing, a State Department program that gives foreign governments money to purchase U.S. weapons. So $10 billion over 5 years, that's $2 billion a year. That is a lot. It might not sound like much when we're talking about Ukraine, but $2 billion a year is a lot of military aid for the U.S. to hand out each year. Under this arrangement, Taiwan would be able to use $300 million of the foreign military financing each year to purchase equipment from its own industrial base. So they would be able to use $300 million out of the $2 billion that they get each year to buy weapons made in Taiwan. And that privilege, when it comes to foreign military financing recipients, FMF, I'll use the abbreviation, Israel is currently the only one that can use some of their FMF to purchase weapons that they make inside Israel. Other FMF recipients, they need to get waivers to use that money to purchase weapons that are not made by the U.S. So the $10 billion, it's a massive increase from the $4.5 billion that was initially proposed by Senators Bob Menendez and Lindsey Graham in a piece of legislation known as the Taiwan Policy Act. So I've been covering this bill, the Taiwan Policy Act, quite a bit because it's really a big deal. It's really going to change what they're trying to do, U.S. policy toward Taiwan. I mean, giving them $10 billion in military aid is pretty huge. But initially it was $4.5 billion, and then the Senate Foreign Relations Committee advanced the bill and added another $2 billion, and they brought it up to $6.5 billion. But now they've decided that they want to put this military aid into the NDAA, and an amendment that was added to it brought it up to $10 billion. So the Taiwan Policy Act, it included other measures that would have boosted diplomatic ties with Taiwan. It would have required sanctions in the event of Chinese aggression toward the island, and it would give Taiwan the benefit of being a major non-NATO ally. But those aspects of the bill are not included in this NDAA amendment, so it's just the military aid that they're sneaking in here. And now the Senate is expected to vote on its version of the NDAA when Congress returns to Washington after the midterm elections in November. So once the Senate approves its version, then the House and the Senate negotiate the final version that will go to Biden's desk. And in that process, in that conference, amendments can be changed. So this $10 billion, I doubt that they're going to take it out completely. I think there's a lot of bipartisan support for giving Taiwan lots of military aid. It's possible they could lower it a bit, but I don't know. I mean, they're just so set on spending all this money on arming other countries. I mean, you just look at all the money that they're approving for Ukraine. So the Senate's effort to give Taiwan this massive amount of military aid, it comes as tensions are soaring between the U.S. and China over Taiwan. China's unprecedented military drills in response to Nancy Pelosi visiting Taiwan and its rhetoric over the issue make it very clear that more U.S. support for Taiwan, more movement in this direction, makes a conflict in the region more likely. I think it's pretty clear the way things are going here, but that's not going to stop them. They're doing this, you know, when you hear them talk about this, they say they're doing it in the name of deterrence. Their argument is that they didn't do enough for Ukraine before Russia, before this current war started, even though, you know, U.S. involvement and intervention in Ukraine played such a major role in provoking the war. But in their minds, maybe, I don't know if they really believe this stuff themselves, but they think they didn't do enough. So for Taiwan, they want Taiwan to be different. But Chinese officials have just repeatedly warned recently that more U.S. support for Taiwan could lead to war. And that doesn't mean a full-scale invasion. There's other, because that would be such a massive military operation. China does not want to do that, but there's other options they could take, such as a blockade. You know, there's a lot of things that could happen. And it's just, we're just really moving in this direction. All right. So the next one, this is actually from Asia Times, and it is about how the chip war, this is the economic aspect of the U.S., China, the U.S. campaign against China. The chip war policy is hurting U.S. firms more than China. And this is by Scott Foster. So this article just says on October 7th, the Department of Commerce, it expanded licensing requirements for exports of advanced semiconductors and the equipment that's used to make them to cover all shipments to China and not just shipments to particular companies. So this is a pretty big deal. I mean, there's been a lot of these export restrictions, and this latest one when it comes to chips seems to be pretty significant. And this is a sign that although it's something that would take extreme effort to really do a full decoupling from China, because their U.S. and Chinese economies are so intertwined, this is a sign that we're really going in that direction, because this is a pretty drastic measure. And as this article goes over, all these American chip companies have seriously taken a hit because of these chip restrictions. Intel, for example, was down 56%. Micron was down 50%. NVIDIA was down 69%. AMD, 67%. So that's pretty significant. And it goes over how, you know, Chinese companies took a hit too, including their top foundry, which was down 40%, but not as significant as the hits that the U.S. took. But this is really, as this article says, it's a pretty aggressive policy, and the industry is really taking a hit because of all these sanctions and stuff. You know, not just in the U.S. but also U.S. allies that have been pressured, that are being pressured not to sell certain things to China. There's a company in the Netherlands that really took a hit over this, in Japan. So it's just more this economic side to this that has really backfired, you know, has been hurting American companies a lot. Okay, so the next one here, this is more with this NDAA. So senators introduced an amendment to the Senate version, again, to the Senate version of the 2023 NDAA, that would give the Pentagon what they call wartime procurement powers, allowing it to purchase more arms for Ukraine. So according to Defense News, again, so this NDAA stuff is pretty confusing and tough to follow. And a big reason why is because they introduce like thousands of amendments, and then they pick a few that get added on. But if you go try to read them, it's just the wording, it's very confusing. The Taiwan one was actually pretty simple, but this, for example, is pretty tough. And Defense News usually does a pretty good job of explaining it. But so this amendment would allow the Pentagon to purchase arms using multi-year contracting authorities, which are typically reserved for procuring naval vessels and warplanes. So really big purchases of really big equipment. You know, it takes a long time for these contracts to work out, because they take a while to manufacture and deliver, and then there's training. But this seems like just the way that they worded it, that it's mostly, this would be more focused on smaller arms, the type of things that they've been sending to Ukraine, such as Stinger missiles, the howitzers, and stuff like that. So it would grant the Pentagon the power to lock in contracts for the fiscal year 2023 and 2024 to buy munitions, and it mentions specific U.S. manufacturers, Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, and then also Bay Systems and Kongsberg Defense and Aerospace. Kongsberg is a Norwegian company, I believe, but they make an air missile defense system that the U.S. uses, and that it's been says that it's going to give to Ukraine as well. And Raytheon, of course, I have to mention, is the former employer of Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense. He was a board member before he took his post at the Pentagon. And these weapons makers, they've really been cashing in on the U.S. and NATO policy of arming Ukraine. And the idea of this amendment would be to incentivize them to increase the production of certain arms. The legislation would also allow the Pentagon to partner with NATO to purchase weapons for alliance members in mass quantities. So another thing that's going on here is a lot of these NATO countries, that there's a lot of former Soviet states in NATO now, and a lot of them still use older Russian-made equipment, but they want to transfer them to NATO equipment. So that's another way that they're going to be cashing in on this. And the amendment would also remove other bureaucratic barriers. It would allow the Pentagon to purchase weapons for Ukraine with non-competitive contracts. So that would make the process a little faster. It would also waive a requirement for contractors to provide what they call certified cost and pricing data. And these things are required to make sure that the Pentagon is paying a fair price, a reasonable price. So they're going to waive that. So this means they could probably charge more for these weapons. I mean, it's just really working out for them. And the legislation, it shows that Congress expects to be supporting Ukraine in its war for years to come. As Politico reported last week, NATO has a 10-year plan to rebuild Ukraine's military and arms industry, to shift the country's armed forces from using Soviet weapons to primarily NATO weapons. So this quote is amazing. A senior congressional aide speaking with Defense News said that the amendment could also be used to purchase weapons so the U.S. could better confront China. This senior congressional aide spoke on the condition of anonymity and said, quote, "We can't pussyfoot around with minimum sustaining rate buys of these munitions. It's hard to think of something as high on everybody's list as buying a ton of munitions for the next few years for our operational plans against China and continuing to supply Ukraine," end quote. So, I mean, it sounds like that this is an amendment that they're going to give the Pentagon these wartime powers, but it doesn't seem like it's specifically for Ukraine. They can use it to buy whatever they want, it seems like, according to the way this is characterized by Defense News and this congressional aide. So again, the Senate has to still pass its version, and then the Senate and the House negotiate. So there's a chance that this amendment could be changed. But I follow this stuff, so I'll keep you updated on it as we move along here. But I just want to take the moment, you know, speaking of all this money that the Pentagon is getting and that Congress is forking over, we at antiwar.com, we need some money. And unfortunately, we don't get nearly enough as they do. We're entirely dependent on our readers. Our fundraiser has been moving along a bit slow. You know, we're making progress, and we appreciate everything that we get. But we just got a nice big boost from some of our generous donors, some of our bigger donors. They have pledged up to $31,000 in matching funds. And that means we have to raise that amount in individual donations to match it, to secure those funds. So if we get up to that point, this could help us finish our fundraiser much more quickly. You can go to antiwar.com/donate to help out. And please subscribe to our newsletters. If you go to antiwar.com/newsletter, you'll see we have a weekly one as well as a daily one. And there you'll get letters about our fundraisers. And again, I mean, we've just been endorsed by some pretty amazing, incredible people. Noam Chomsky, Colonel Douglas McGregor, John Mearsheimer. So, you know, if they are telling you to support us, I think you should listen to them. And again, you know, you see what we're up against. I mean, the mainstream media, they get all this corporate money, and there's just so much money in keeping and controlling the narrative. And they want to erase all the history before February 24th, where we try to give you the information in context. That's very important. So please help us out. antiwar.com/donate. Okay, next story here. Russia says that it launched more attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure. So Russia on Monday said that it launched attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure as Kiev came under bombardment by Russian kamikaze drones. So a Russian defense ministry spokesman said that the Russian armed forces continued delivering strikes across Ukraine, and they are saying that all the targets they wanted to hit were hit. Ukraine's prime minister said that Russian kamikaze drones struck energy infrastructure in Kiev, and rocket attacks were launched in two other regions near around the city of Dnipro and the Sumy Oblast. And he said hundreds of residential areas have lost power as a result of the attacks. According to South Front, Russian kamikaze drones also struck an energy facility in Odessa. In Kiev, authorities said that a Russian drone hit an apartment building and that four civilians were killed in the strikes. So the drones that they're using are known as Geranium-2 drones, Russian Geranium-2s. But the U.S. and Ukraine and a lot of other people are alleging that they're the same as these Iranian-made drones, the Shahed-136. So they're saying Iran sold Russia these drones, and then Russia painted them and gave them a different name and then deployed them in Ukraine. For their part, Iran denies it. We'll get more into that in the next story. They deny that they've provided Russia with weapons that they can use in Ukraine. But Monday's attacks on Ukraine's civilian infrastructure, they appear to be the most intense since Russia launched large-scale missile strikes across Ukraine early last week in response to the truck bombing of the Kerch Bridge, which connects Crimea and Russia. And so they've continued, you know, these attacks on infrastructure since then, but not as intense as those first couple of days. So this seems to be the most intense since then. And this comes after, as I went over yesterday, the uptick in Ukrainian shelling of Russia's Belgorod Oblast, which borders Ukraine. And Putin had previously warned that Russia would step up strikes across Ukraine in response to what he calls Ukrainian terror attacks on Russian territories. Now, I haven't seen Russian officials explicitly say that that's what these drone strikes and other strikes were a response to, but I think kind of expected something like this to happen after seeing all those attacks in Belgorod. All right. So the next one that we got here, the EU approves. Oh, wait, sorry. Did I miss something? No, sorry. The EU approves a program to train thousands of Ukrainian troops in Ukraine. So the EU on Monday announced that it will be training Ukrainian troops in Europe, and they also announced a plan to provide Kiev with $486 million to purchase weapons. The training mission's initial goal will be to train 15,000 Ukrainian troops. The mission's headquarters will be based in Brussels, but the bulk of the training is expected to take place in Germany and in Poland. The training mission's budget is about $107 million and will be overseen by a French naval officer. So several EU member states and other NATO members that aren't EU members have already been training Ukrainian soldiers in Europe. But now the EU is going to be doing its own training mission. And the US and Britain have been training Ukrainian troops a lot. The U.S. military has been training them in Germany and in other undisclosed locations in Europe on how to use U.S.-provided arms. Infantry training has been taking place in the U.K., and other Western nations have aided in that effort, including Canada, New Zealand, and the Netherlands. The U.S. and NATO began training Ukraine's military back in 2014, following the U.S.-backed ousting of Viktor Yanukovych, the former Ukrainian president. And that sparked Russia taking Crimea and the separatists in the Donbass declaring independence from Kiev. So the U.S. withdrew its trainers from Ukraine shortly before Russia invaded on February 24th. We don't know if they withdrew all of them at that time. But some media outlets have reported that there is a presence of special operations forces from the U.S. and other NATO states in Ukraine since, you know, now as the war has been going on. So back in April, the Times, this is the Times of London, they reported that British Special Air Service troops were in Kiev training Ukrainians on how to use UK-provided anti-tank weapons. And then in June, the New York Times reported that commandos from the UK, France, Canada, and Lithuania were inside Ukraine training and advising Ukrainian forces. And The Intercept very recently reported that there are U.S. Special Operations Forces in Ukraine, and to my knowledge, that's the first report that said that. It's not really a surprise, but I haven't seen it reported anywhere else. But that they didn't say what they were doing, you know, it's kind of light on the details in that aspect. And CIA operatives are also on the ground in Ukraine, But again, we don't really know what they're doing. You know, before the current war, when the Donbass war was going on from 2014 until February 24th, that version of the war, there was a report from Yahoo News of, earlier this year that revealed CIA paramilitary forces were deployed to the front lines of the Donbass war to train Ukrainians. So, you know, this has been going on for a long time. It's not like this is all new, but all right. So the next one we got here, Russia and Syria kill 20 in anti-ISIS operation. So this is a, Russia said this was a response to last week's bus bombing in Damascus, Syria, that killed a good amount, I believe 18 Syrian soldiers. So Syria and Russia, they launched 2 days of offensive in and around Dara, Syria. And they said that around 20 fighters have been killed. They're saying that they are ISIS fighters. And, you know, ISIS in Syria right now, there's really just remnants of them. They don't really have a stronghold anywhere in the country, kind of just in rural areas where they can, you know, hold up. But it seems like a pretty big operation against them by Russia and Syria. Okay. So the next one, this is more about those Iranian drones. So the EU warns Iran of more sanctions over its alleged arms supplies for Russia. EU ministers on Monday agreed to sanction Iranian officials over their alleged roles in cracking down on protests inside Iran, and warned of more potential sanctions if they can prove that Iran has provided Russia with drones for its war effort. So again, Ukraine's capital came under attack by these Geranium-2 Russian drones that they're saying are actually Iranian. And so what's interesting about this, I mean, if you read AP, New York Times, all the Western media are just basically reporting it as fact that Russia is using Iranian drones, which they could be. I really don't know. I'm not sure. But I thought it was interesting because the EU is saying that they might sanction Iran over it if they can prove it, if they can find concrete evidence. So then they don't really know for sure. So Joseph Borrell, he is the EU's foreign policy chief. He said that EU ministers will discuss how to respond to the attacks and Iran's. They're going to debate Iran's alleged role and what to do about it if they determine that they are helping Russia. And again, you know, it's the EU, so who knows how honest of an investigation they'll put into it. But Borrell said, quote, "This is something that will be discussed and we will look for concrete evidence about the participation of Iran in the war," end quote. So Iran on Monday, they denied that it supplied, that they supplied Russia with drones that could be used in Ukraine. So the US has been claiming this for a few months that Iran was selling Russia drones. And I also believe there was good sources on it. You know, comments from IRGC officials kind of hinting at it. But still, I mean, Iran is denying it. I think it's just good to point out. So Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said, quote, "The published news about Iran providing Russia with drones has political ambitions and it's circulated by Western sources. We have not provided weaponry to any side of the countries at war," end quote. And then the White House responded and accused Iran of lying. So the White House, the U.S. is just saying, yeah, they are, like, for sure, Iranian drones. The White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, said that Iran is lying. So we'll see where that goes. But the last news story here, this is from Kyle Anzalone at the Libertarian Institute. The U.S. seeks to upgrade its ability to fight economic wars. So U.S. officials are meeting with their British counterparts this week to increase cooperation regarding sanctions enforcement against Moscow. And this meeting comes as the U.S. is struggling to get its Gulf partners to comply with its economic war on Russia. They've been struggling to get a lot of people to comply with it. But U.S. and British officials are meeting. They did meet on Monday to discuss this. You know, they've been struggling trying to figure out a way to hurt Russia, as Russia is selling more, has been just making a lot more profit off selling oil and stuff like that since before the war. So they're kind of looking at ways to hurt them. And they still have this, it looks like the G7 are going to try to enforce this price cap on Russian oil come December. And I think that's going to be a disaster, because I think Russia is just going to respond by cutting off more countries and potentially cutting oil production pretty significantly. That will really send prices, you know, gas prices, we're really going to feel that if they do something significant in response to that. You know, they're just not in the position to be pressuring Russia and these other countries on this issue, but they're going to keep trying, even though it's going to hurt Americans and Europeans. But that's it for the news. We have a lot of good viewpoints, as always. There's a really good one that's at Responsible Statecraft from Jack Matlock, who was the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1987 to 1991, and it's titled "Why the U.S. Must Press for a Ceasefire in Ukraine." And you know, this is a common thing. You see, U.S. people that have worked as diplomats during the Cold War are really outspoken against the current madness that's going on today. The lack of dialogue with Russia when we're at the highest risk of nuclear Armageddon than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Or that's how the president put it, at least. So that's pretty concerning. But that's it for today. Again, please help us with our fundraiser, antiwar.com/donate. Oh, and the show. So we have the video on YouTube, Odyssey, and we're on Rumble now. I just added it to Rumble. So if you like watching videos there, you can go check it out. And then audio, of course, you could download the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. But yeah, that's it. I'll be back tomorrow with some more news. Thank you for listening.